At the close of chapter 30 last week, Job's situation had maybe summarized in this way. All of his joy has been turned into deep grief. Secondly, his honor has been turned into shame through no fault of his own. His friends were gone. Even the three that came to visit him turned out, as we saw, to be, in his own words, miserable comforters. Then all those who had hitherto regarded him with the highest reverence now treated him with contempt and shunned him. To make matters worse, his health was shattered and he was in constant pain. And as a consequence of disease, his skin had blackened and roughened, had turned unsightly. And the poor man never knew what brought all this about. Unknown to him, all this was brought about by the hand of Satan, as permitted or given the leeway to do so by God. We must understand his situation at the close of chapter 30 in order that we may correctly appraise chapter 31. As mentioned last week, chapter 31 is in effect his deposition. In legal terms, his final defense. And after this chapter, by his own admission, the words of Job are ended. So this, to me, this is a particularly important chapter. It marks a watershed. What is the background to this oath of innocence which Job will declare by way of the content of chapter 31? As you would have noticed, there have been three cycles of speeches. And throughout those three cycles of speeches, Job has consistently been declaring his innocence and appealing for God to give him a fair hearing in open court. But of course, to no avail. He has gone through all the motions of appeal and it has availed him nothing. Therefore, we find him in chapter 31 at the point where he realizes that there is nothing more left for him to say by way of appeal. It has come to a do or die situation, and therefore chapter 31 is his do or die statement. Why I say it in those terms is there is an abrupt transition in Job from merely declaring his innocence and appealing for the right to have an open hearing to a state where he swears an oath of innocence. And the difference is vast, because by swearing an oath of innocence, Job has in effect put God in a position whereby if God remains silent, then that would be to the discredit of God. And if God is God, a just and holy God, because the accused has sworn an oath of innocence, God now must openly declare the basis for his charges. And either as a result of that open examination, either declare Job as truly innocent or as guilty. And that is why I describe it as a do or die situation. And there is no more turning back, there is no more hedging about, because of this oath of innocence. Of course, we are putting it in human terms. No man can actually, as it were, put God in a spot. But in human terms, if God were a human judge who has been, so to speak, dragging his feet, which has been sometimes the perception wrong of course, but sometimes the perception of Job, if God has been like a human judge dragging his feet, then this oath of innocence will propel him, the judge, to make a statement. Therefore, chapter 31 must be read in that light, and it is a turning point. At four distinct places in the text, how does Job declare his oath of innocence? What form does it take? It takes a very elaborate form. It goes like this. There are four specific points in the text whereby Job identifies exactly what curse should befall him if he were to be found guilty. So note these four specific curses. The first, which I draw to your attention, is in verse 8. Then let me sow, and let another eat, yea, let my offspring be rooted out. Please bear in mind that the Hebrew root word corresponding to offspring is seetzer, which can mean literally offspring, but it can also mean the produce of the earth. For example, the same thought is found in Leviticus 26, the third part of the 16th verse. Ye shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. So the context must guide us. If you look at the parallelism in verse 8, let me sow and let another eat. This is a synthetic parallelism. Therefore, we cannot maintain that the offspring in the second half refers to the grain, refers to the children of Job. It has to refer to the grain that is planted in his fields. In other words, he and his servants may plant plentifully, but the harvest will be reaped by strangers, and the strangers will benefit. So that is a curse upon a man in an agricultural society. It is a disaster for a farmer that the immense labor of planting a field, the benefit of the harvest should go to a complete stranger. And that is the curse that Job wishes upon himself if he were to be found guilty. So bear in mind again the importance of the context in deciding the appropriate meaning. Second curse that Job wishes upon himself if he were to be found guilty is a very interesting one. Verse 10, if I am guilty, then he says, then let my wife grind unto another, and let others bow down, that is to say, bear down upon her. To put it in simple terms, if I am guilty, let my wife be subjected to the greatest humiliation and degradation. The grinding comes about like this. The work of grinding at the mill was typically undertaken by slaves, and by female slaves in particular. The way Job speaks about such an event, should it occur, is that if his wife should be reduced to this state of being enslaved to a stranger, then, says Job, he would consider it the greatest possible humiliation, the most painful of all the punishments that could be imposed upon him. Why, and this is a side issue, why is this verse a very interesting one? Because it helps us to put to rest the dispute over the first wife of Job. Was she still with him? Did she desert him? Did he divorce her? Did she die? He must have married again if she had died, because at the final stage he had again 7 sons and 3 daughters. So was that the second wife? The way he speaks about this matter, let my wife go into servitude, should I be found guilty, indicates that the wife he was referring to was his first and only wife, and that therefore she had to be very much alive and still in the family home. She had not run away from him, even though she had called upon him to curse God and die. We also see in this statement of Job, where he says that if he were guilty, and as a consequence his wife go into servitude to another person, he would consider this the most painful of all punishments, indicates to us how much he still valued and loved that first wife, despite the fact that it was she who had cried out to him to curse God and die. In other words, that Job saw through her mere words and appreciated the fact that she was speaking ill-advisedly in a fit of emotion, and that was not her usual self. We see in this the kind of forbearance, compassion, and love that a Christian husband should have for his wife. And this simple statement of Job, if we read it with a proper understanding, this discloses a world of meaning as regards the relationship of a Christian husband to a Christian wife. It recalls the injunction given by the Apostle Peter to husbands in 1 Peter chapter 3 verse 7. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them, referring to the wife, according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life. Now, before some of you raise your hands in protest, the phrase weaker vessel does not mean what you and I might be tempted to think. There is no hint or suggestion of inferiority in intellect, in accomplishments, in ability, or any such thing. The weaker vessel means simply that women, and wives in particular, are by their very nature and constitution more susceptible to reacting adversely when under emotional duress. This, I believe, is borne out by observations in daily life. And that is all that is implied by the phrase weaker vessel. And because husbands should recognize this so-called inbuilt feature of the makeup of the wife, he should give particular honor, that is particular attention to the wife. And this requirement Job amply fulfilled, because he shows in the midst of his personal suffering an enormous degree of compassion and love and restraint. He had no ill feelings towards his wife for having left him alone. He had only pity for her. He still cared for her, to the extent of saying that if, as a result of he being found guilty, she should go into servitude, he wouldn't clap his hands and say, "Serves her right, she deserves it for opening her big mouth." But he would say, rather, that I am the one more hurt than she. So that's the sermon on how husbands should treat their wives, all out of just one verse, verse 10. That's the second curse. The third curse that Job wishes upon himself if he were to be found guilty is another very dramatic one. It's personal. Verse 22. If I'm guilty of the list of sins listed prior to this verse, then comes verse 22, let mine arm fall from my shoulder blade. And by the way, the Hebrew word for arm is the entire arm. It's not just the forearm, but the entire arm fall from my shoulder blade, and mine arm be broken from the bone. This is a reference to the entire arm from shoulder to fingers being rendered useless. If it could be established that Job was guilty of the acts and the attitude that is referred to in verses 16 through 21. In particular, this verse 22, this curse that he wishes upon himself if found guilty, is in relation to the fact that if it could be established that he was ever guilty of taking advantage of an orphan, then let this curse come upon him. But there's a whole list of things that any one of which Job says should precipitate this disaster, where one or both of his arms is rendered completely useless. We are reminded of a parallel usage in many places in the Psalms. For example, the famous Psalm 137, by the rivers of Babylon, that is unfortunately adopted as the opening verse to a rock ballad. So we are not referring to that. We are referring to the original Psalm 137, verses 5 and 6. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember, forget her cunning means unable to do any of its normal tasks, basically become useless. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. It is certainly very strong language, and you ask yourself this, would any human being in his right mind invite such curses upon himself? Because you really never know, the way human beings sin is so natural, we don't even have to think and plan about it. It's almost like breathing. We don't, not even aware that we are breathing. We are not even aware that every 1/48th of a second the eyes blink once. We are not aware of it. And that is how natural it is for human beings to sin. It is therefore entirely possible that we might be guilty of any one of the list of sins that Job gives and not even be aware of it. Therefore, it is extremely dangerous for any human being, and certainly for Job, to make this move of saying, if I'm guilty of any one of the above, let these, well, up till now, three curses, and there's one more to go, three and eventually four curses fall upon me, because the curses that he has enumerated thus far, and the fourth curse will be no different, are exceptionally severe and terrifying. No human being in his right senses would make that kind of a move unless he were totally convinced of his innocence. You don't play the fool with words, because in inviting that curse, you are actually inviting God to visit you with that kind of judgment. And that is no joking matter at all. Therefore, it indirectly attests to the strength of Job's conviction of his innocence. And in verse 40, the final curse he wishes upon himself, if the list of sins preceding verse 40 can be proven against me, says Job, let thistles grow instead of wheat and cockle instead of barley. The cockle has no reference to the cockle and mussels that we think of. The cockle is a term for a type of noxious weed which, like the thistle, once it takes root, is said to be very hard to eradicate. Remember, this was in ancient times where they had no weed killers as we have today. And even today with weed killers, so many species of weed have become resistant. Therefore, if these two particularly noxious weeds were to invade a farm, that farmer is in real trouble because they would quickly overrun the farm. And that means economic disaster overnight. So, in an agricultural context, it's a very terrible curse for a person involved in farming to utter against himself. Let my fields be laid waste by these noxious and hard to eradicate weeds if I am proven guilty of the specific list of sins. These four curses may be rightfully termed imprecations. Now, normally one would utter an imprecation against one's enemy. Here, Job takes an extraordinary position of uttering these four imprecations against himself. If anyone could ever show that he was guilty of any of a whole list of sins which are specified. And again, this move is not simply a matter of desperation. It is partly that, of course, he's driven by desperation. But Job never lost the clear logical thinking that has characterized him from beginning and will continue to characterize him through to the end of the book. By God's grace, he retained a very clear head upon his shoulders through the worst of times. So this was not simply a man in desperation uttering anything just to find some way of getting out of the situation. He knew what he was doing. He knew, he had examined himself before he ever opened his mouth, that he was not in any way guilty of any of a whole list of sins. And we will see later there are 13 categories of sins, and in each category there would be subcategories. So the 13 categories cover an entire gamut, practically all the sins that human beings could ever do. Job says, if you could prove that I am guilty of any one of these, then let these curses fall upon me. Please bear in mind, Job, this is not equivalent to saying, to Job saying, I am sinless. It is equivalent to Job saying, whenever, wherever I have committed any one of these sins, I have always without delay repented and asked God for forgiveness. This was his characteristic in regard to himself and his entire family, for we read of him regularly offering up sacrifices for the specific purpose of a sin offering on behalf of himself and his family. So therefore, Job is not saying that he is sinless, but he is maintaining that if I am guilty of any one of these sins and have not repented, even though I know I should, then yes, I stand guilty as charged, and yes, I am ready to face the consequences. If you think about it, there can be no clearer proof of a person's innocence than when he puts himself out on the limb. If you look at Old Testament history, you will find that this practice of Job, swearing an oath of innocence, is a practice that is actually followed in its intent much, much later under the Levitical system, because whenever the Israelites approached the temple for worship, before they ever went into the temple precincts, it was required of them to examine themselves, and if they were convinced that they were free or had dealt with a whole list of sins in the right way, they were honestly free of these sins, then they were required to make a ritual confession before entering the table a confession to the effect that they had observed the law inwardly and outwardly in thought, feeling, word and deed. So in essence, this practice is a reflection of a much earlier practice that Job personally followed. You will find the details in Deuteronomy chapter 26, verses 13 and 14. I leave it to you to read that. A person who stands accused would typically, if you look at the pattern of human beings, a person who stands accused would, the first reaction of the person who's accused would be to deny all wrongdoing. You know, human beings, human nature has not changed. The cosmetic factors have changed, but the heart and the behavior of the human beast has not changed. Therefore, we can use a modern, very present example to illustrate this point. I cannot mention names for fear of being sued, but you will gather or you will glean from my statements who I'm referring to. The former head of the International Monetary Fund was arrested when he was about to board an aircraft to return to his home country. And when he was charged with sexual wrongdoing of molesting and raping a hotel chambermaid, his immediate reaction was to deny all guilt. I am being wrongfully accused. That was his consistent cry, whether he was coached to do that by his legal team or it came from his own heart, only he can attest to that. But that was his public reaction. I'm not guilty. I've been exploited. This woman is after money. She's trying to blackmail me. And that was his song all the way until the evidence, irrefutable evidence, surfaced. And then that song got changed just a little bit. Oh yes, I am guilty, but it wasn't rape. It was what they call consensual. Frankly, I do not know what that means. But it was consensual. So now it is not outright denial, it is yes, but. And this is a typical reaction of the human nature. So in that sense, you can't blame the person concerned. He is behaving true to form, an unsaved human being. Job, on the other hand, before he opens his mouth, he tests himself. He lists the categories of sin that he is dealing with, and he has scrupulously tested himself inwardly first before opening his mouth and declaring his conviction. So now we have to ask ourselves, so much has been said about categories of sin. What exactly is Job talking about? Yes, believe it or not, there are 13 categories of sin, and bear in mind that each of these categories may well cover a series of subcategories. So the total would probably run into many more numbers, much greater than 13. But the 13 major categories are as follows. Lust, that is in verse 1. Deception or guile, that is in verse 5. Covetousness, verse 7. Adultery, verse 9, shabby treatment of one's employees or subordinates, verse 13. Those of you who are still, unfortunately, still have to work and work under unfair bosses, you might slip this extract from the book of Job, chapter 31, under the table for the boss to read. Shabby treatment of one's subordinates or employees, God regards this as a punishable offense. Withholding compassion and mercy from the poor, the widow and the orphan, or exploiting them, verses 16 through 21. Idolatry, And please bear in mind, this is much more than just bowing down to statues. Idolatry in any form could include the love of money, a particular hobby that is so captivating that in itself not wrong, but you have allowed it to become your master, to control. It has become the first priority in your life. Therefore, by definition, it is your idol. So really, this category is very wide indeed. Idolatry, properly applied, it can apply to a very wide category of activities, each of which may not in themselves be wrong, but it is your response to them that makes it wrong. So idolatry, Job says he has never been guilty. He has never, even though he was immensely wealthy, never has the love of money ever been a part of his life. Vengeful attitude towards his opponents or enemies. Never once, says Job, have I ever exulted when an enemy of mine has fallen upon hard times. Never have I let myself say, serves him right. We are often tempted to say that inwardly, not outwardly, but Job says even that attitude never came upon me. Withholding benevolence, verse 31. Withholding hospitality, verse 32. Hypocrisy, which involves a concealment of sin, making oneself out to be better than one really is. Verse 33, Job says, that too I am free of. And here's another sin which very often besets those who hold public office. And that sin is pandering to popular opinion. Verse 34. And the 13th category is injustice and crime, what we might call white-collar crime in one's public life. Verses 38 and 39. In this list of sins, we note two types. Sins that involve action as well as sins that involve the intention, the heart. An example of a sin in action indeed would be the shabby treatment of one's subordinates or employees. What about a sin of intent? That's quite easy. When one harbors thoughts of revenge against those who have done wrong to us, then that would be a sin of intent. If you think about it, this discussion of the 13 categories of sin that Job says he is free of ever indulging, in his analysis of the whole situation, does he not display a profound moral insight? And does it not call to mind an event much later where the same moral insight was exhibited? Can you recall where else in the Bible the same profound moral insight was shown as in these verses taken from chapter 31? No lesser place than the Sermon on the Mount. It's a very similar pattern. So really, from the time of Job, Job's insight was 2,000 years ahead of his time. Now, in listing these sins, of course, I mentioned there is a common pattern. First and foremost, that is the definition of the sin. Then there is the protest of innocence, an emphatic declaration that he is free of the sin just described. And in each instance, that description is followed by the oath, may God do such and such to me if I am proven guilty. This, the very fact that the name of God is invoked, identifies this as a deadly serious oath. You do not ever take oaths invoking the name of God without being aware of the consequences. That, by the way, was the capital mistake made by two people in the New Testament. They were believers, or we assume they were believers, but they made this capital mistake of swearing an oath to God or invoking the name of God and saying, I will do this, and then carrying it out only partially. And the consequence of that was death. It was death by the hand of God Himself. I'm of course referring to Ananias and Sapphira. So taking an oath and invoking God is a deadly serious matter, and one should refrain from taking such an oath unless one is thoroughly aware of the consequences and one knows exactly what one is doing. Now we start off with lust, only because that is in the first in the list. Verses 1 through 4. I made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I think upon a maid? For what portion of God is there from above, and what inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is not destruction to the wicked, and strange punishment, this will be explained, strange punishment to the workers of iniquity? Doth not He, that is God, see my ways and count all my steps? Why the eyes? Because in the Old Testament, the eyes were regarded as the doorway to the heart. A mere gaze in the right circumstances could inflame or excite a swell of emotion that could easily sweep the beholder into the throes of sin. You only have to recall poor David and his roaming eyes to realize how dangerous it can be to look. That doesn't mean we wear thick sunglasses, nor does it mean we voluntarily blind ourselves, because it is not merely a matter of the eyes, it is really ultimately a matter of the heart, because that is where, that is the seat of all of these sins, the sinful heart of man. The eyes are merely the doorway to the heart that allows the stimuli to come in. But even if there are no external stimuli, man by nature being sinful will find ways to stimulate these sinful desires in him, no different from lust. What is the strange punishment referred to in verse 3? For strange, we go back to the Hebrew root word neker, which means literally out of the ordinary. Therefore, strange punishment would mean unusually severe calamity, which indeed is justified for those who are guilty of lust. For when one indulges in lust as David did, God warns ahead of time that He will impose punishment that is out of the ordinary, indicative therefore of His special displeasure. So that is lust. Deception or guile, verses 5 and 6. If I have walked with vanity, or if my foot hath hasted to deceit, let me be weighed in an even balance, that God may know mine integrity. Here Job consents to having his life examined according to the most rigorous standards, and if he be found guilty, to be punished without any concession whatsoever. What do I mean by concession? Example: under Singapore law, a male above the age of 60 will be spared the cane even if the offense requires caning as part of the punishment. So he is given that concession in view of his age. Of course, women, whatever their age and however dastardly the sin, are spared the cane. One wonders why. So that's another issue altogether. So Job says that I will not, even if I had opportunity to seek that kind of relief, I would not ask for it, or I would waive my right to such relief if I were to be found guilty. Now, is this arrogance on his part? Knowing the character of Job, as attested by no lesser person than God himself in verses one, in chapters 1 and 2, this attitude cannot be taken as one of arrogance, but on the contrary, as indicative of the strength of his conviction of innocence from any of the sins that he has stated thus far. So we have dealt with lust, and then deception or guile. Covetousness, verses 7 and 8. If my step hath turned out of the way, and mine heart walked after mine eyes, and if any blot hath cleaved to mine hand, then let me sow and let another eat, yea, let my offspring be rooted out. There are actually two separate sins referred to here by Job. There is covetousness and fraud, which is driven by covetousness and often accompanied by violence. Job affirms his readiness to face the Jews upon conviction of either charge. And then we come to a very interesting sin which requires to be discussed in a little more detail. We do have the time for that. Adultery, verses 9 through 12. I must state upfront that Job, having discussed this sin as he did the others, declares emphatically that he is free of adultery and its twin fornication in any form, outwardly or inwardly. He is totally positive about that. Now let's look at the discussion that Job offers on adultery, verses 9 through 12. If mine heart had been deceived by a woman, and we need to know what is the Hebrew root for that, or if I have laid wait at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind unto another, and let others bear down upon her. For this is an heinous crime, yea, it is an iniquity to be punished by the judges, for it is a fire that consumeth to destruction and would root out all mine increase. In the first verse of chapter 31, the woman that is referred to in relation to lust is actually Betulah, which means a virgin, and that has to be explained further along these lines. Virgin meaning an unmarried woman, possibly betrothed but not yet married formally, still living at her family home, and who has never had sexual relations with any man. It may appear to be a convoluted definition, but I have tried to cover all the loopholes, and the result is a somewhat unwieldy definition. The Betulah referred to here is an unmarried woman, possibly betrothed, but still living at her family home, and who has never had sexual relations with any man. In the Old Testament, Betulah, as you may know, is the most commonly used term for virgin. Account indicates that it is used at least 50 times. In contrast, or in comparison with which, is a much rarer term, Alma, which is used a total of 9 times. So it is said. So what is the distinction between the two? The root word for Alma is Elam, which is a masculine root, and it refers to youth, a young person. So from the origins of the word Alma, we may infer that it refers, it's of course practically identical with Betulah, with a subtle nuance that is missing in Betulah. Alma refers to a young woman of marriageable age, that is, who has just attained puberty, who has never had sexual relations with any man. And of course, such an individual would be living under the protection of the parental home. in verse 9, if my heart had been deceived by a woman, in contrast to the first verse of chapter 31 where Betula is used, in this verse 9, if my heart had been deceived by a woman, the Hebrew word is neither Betula nor Alma, but it is rather Isha, which means woman in general or wife in particular. Therefore, a female who is not a virgin. And that is why the sin that is referred to by Job in verse 9 is not so much fornication, it is adultery, because it involves a female who is not a virgin. I mentioned that adultery and fornication are twins. Indeed they are, and both are declared by Job to be particularly heinous sins that can under no circumstances ever be justified. If they are twins, they are not identical twins. There is a distinction between them, between adultery and fornication. And for those of you who have a passionate interest in splitting hairs, here is an explanation of the distinction. Fornication is a sin against oneself. Certainly from the New Testament perspective, the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. So the sin of fornication is really a sin against oneself. Adultery is of course a sin against oneself also, but it carries an additional payload, and the additional payload is a crime against society. Why is adultery a crime against society? Because it involves a party that rightfully belongs to another person. So when you appropriate what belongs, using the word belongs in inverted commas, to another person, it becomes in effect a crime against society. In fornication, you are hurting primarily yourself. That doesn't mean you can do what you like to yourself, which is why suicide is a sin in God's sight, because the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, and you are not at liberty to do with yourself. You are not at liberty to abuse your body with drink, with drugs, or with sex at all. If you are interested in a detailed commentary on this subject, I would direct you to the 7th chapter of Proverbs. Job says that adultery and fornication are particularly destructive because he compares them to a bushfire. Like a bushfire, like the bushfires we read about in Australia from time to time, they sweep through the heart of a human being, to the whole human being in particular, and leave in their wake utter devastation. An example of the kind of devastation that fornication and adultery can bring upon a human being can be found in the case of the prodigal son, Luke chapter 15. You will find in verses 13 and in verse 30 an explanation of what the effect of indulging in these sins, what effect that had on the young man. As far as Job is concerned, if he could be proven guilty of either fornication or adultery, even once, then, he says, let this most painful of punishments come upon me, namely, let my wife become enslaved to another human being. And by the way, as mentioned, this statement by which Job means that this would be the most painful of all the punishments that God could inflict upon him, it indicates his continuing fidelity to the one and only wife that he has had, which would also indicate that the 10 children who were born to him after his restoration came from the same woman. So really, it is marvelous to see, if you can look at the whole book, if we look at the book as a whole and be always conscious of the details, you will find that many supposed difficulties with this book can be resolved. After all, the Bible is its own best commentary. Now, what is the next sin that Job affirms that he is not guilty of? Shabby treatment of one's subordinates or employees, verses 13 through 15. If I did despise the cause of my manservant or of my maidservant when they contended with me, what then shall I do when God riseth up, and when he visiteth, what shall I answer him? Did not he, that is God, that made me in the womb, make him my servant? And did not one God fashion us in the womb? If you think about it, ancient Israel was unique among ancient Near Eastern cultures in that their slaves definitely had rights. You only have to look at the book of Exodus chapter 21 and Leviticus chapter 25 to realize that the Israelites were required by God to account for the way they treated their slaves. And this was something unique among ancient Near Eastern cultures. Job goes further than that. He says that even if any one of his slaves had a complaint against him personally, he would entertain that complaint in a very objective and impartial way and never take it out on that slave. If you were to apply this principle in your working life and go up to your boss and tell him that I have this objection to you, the way you have treated me, the consequences can be quite unpredictable. The only consolation for you is there are very few Jobs in working life. So maybe we shouldn't try employing this tactic literally. But we can do it in a more subtle way, slipping him an anonymous note. You have not treated me fairly. And let him wonder which employee has the gall to send me that message just before Christmas. Job goes much further, and this is the difference between his merely stating I'm innocent of this sin and what he actually does say. He goes further by saying, by giving the reason, the rationale, why is it that he treats his servants with the same respect that he does any one of his friends, for example. The reason is this: because whether slave or free man, both are, to quote a phrase coined by David, fearfully and wonderfully made by God in their mother's womb. That being the case, on what basis could any man privileged to own slaves, on what basis could he ever regard his slaves as worthless, as having no rights? There's no basis, because it is the same God who made each of these people wonderfully and fearfully in their mother's womb, breathed into them the breath of life, and brought them forth into this world. So really, a sin against any slave considered as made in the image of God is an offense against God. In this perspective, Job was way ahead of his time. As he was in the next category of sin, withholding compassion and mercy from the poor, the widow, and the orphan, or exploiting them. Verses 16 through 20. If I withheld the poor from their desire, or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, and it goes on to, if I have seen any perish for want of clothing, or any poor without covering, if his loins have not blessed me, and if he were not warmed by the fleece of my sheep, if I have lifted up my hand against the fatherless when I saw my help in the gate, then comes the imprecation. Then, verses 22 and 23, then let mine arm fall, that is, fall useless from my shoulder blade, and mine arm be broken from the bone. For destruction from God was a terror to me, and by reason of his highness I could not endure. So really, this category comprises withholding good from those to whom it is due, as well as exploiting those who are powerless to defend themselves. The most unfortunate classes of citizens, not slaves, citizens in ancient times were the poor, the widow, and the orphan. More often than not, they were reduced to begging just to get through from day to day. What is worse than begging? Arguably, it is this: being spurned by the person from whom you are trying to beg help. It's bad enough for a human being made in God's image to be begging for sustenance just for the day. But to beg and then to be spurned, to be told, go away, it reduces that beggar to a state of to a feeling of utter worthlessness. And it is such a terrible feeling. Job says, I have never done this. What is the meaning of this very difficult verse 18? For from my youth he was brought up with me as with a father, and I have guided her from my mother's womb. Without being aware of the context, I can guarantee that this will make no sense to us. But I would suggest the following approach. Read it in the context of the two verses preceding. For from my youth he was brought up with me. The he has to refer to what precedes immediately before this verse, the fatherless in the preceding verse. And what about the her, guided her from my mother's womb? Go one step further back, verse 16. There's a reference to the widow. So what Job is saying is this: he has consistently all through his life specially looked out for the widow and the orphan. And if you take that approach, it all comes together. Verse 20 needs a little bit of explanation. If his loins have not blessed me, what is the meaning of the expression his loins? It is a term used as a synecdoche, in which a part is used to represent the whole, or it could be the other way around, the whole is used to represent the part. So here the phrase his loins are of course a part of a human being, is used to refer to the human being as a whole. The converse of this would be, for example, the English lost the test match. Ordinarily the phrase the English would refer to the nation. Obviously the nation didn't lose the test match, but a tiny portion of the nation lost the test match, namely the English cricket team. So we could say the English cricket team lost the test match. A little cumbersome. Therefore, the use of synecdoche allows us to express it in a more compact form. The English lost the test match. So here is an example of synecdoche. Verse 21, if I have lifted up my hand against the fatherless when I saw my help in the gate. The meaning is this. Job says, if ever I have used my rank, my social status, my influence, my power as a leader of the community to exploit the orphan or fail to afford him the protection he lacks, then the implication follows, let my arm fall useless, and so on. This curse, this imprecation, if it were to be effected, would totally, utterly break Job's strength. What is the underlying sentiment in what Job has expressed thus far? It is this, and it's important for us to realize this. A proper appreciation of the majesty and holiness of God must induce a person to follow after righteousness in all areas of his life. and at the same time eschew even the mere appearance of evil. A proper appreciation of the majesty and holiness of God is the key to living a life pleasing to God. Truly, it has been observed that the fear of God is the basis of wisdom. And if you recall in Job 28, verse 28, that is exactly how the chapter ends. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. We haven't quite finished with chapter 31. We continue, God willing, next Lord's Day.